DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Sarah Steffen in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the show, cocoa farmers in Ivory Coast have been pushed to the limits as the cocoa crisis drags on.
So we're
currently in debt to the school. I haven't been able to pay the school fees. I try to explain to the teachers that I'll be paid soon.
Owners of chicken restaurants in South Korea risk losing it all in a dangerous game of chicken.
Most chicken restaurant owners use their apartments as collateral when they take out a loan to open their restaurants. So they also lose their homes when the business fails.
And who said feeding the poor had to be a grim affair?
Lo que sí queríamos es que tuviese más dignidad, que sean con camareros.
We wanted the Robin Hood restaurant to be a place with dignity, a place where the homeless are served by waiters and can drink out of a glass instead of plastic cups. It's just like in a normal restaurant.
All that and more coming up now. But first, every year the UN comes out with what's called the Human Development Report. It's a ranking how much progress countries have made in terms of development. This year's report focuses on human development for everyone. And we'll get into what that means in a minute. I'm now joined by my colleague Anke Raspa, who spoke to the report's lead author Selim Jahan. Anke, maybe we can start off by explaining what the Human Development Report does and why we need one every year.
Well, basically, the Human Development Report is pretty much a check-up, so to speak, about this year it's 188 countries, so it's almost every country in the world. Governments, for instance, can use it, or NGOs, or people who want to find out where does their country stand on different issues.
And what are the report's main findings?
Well, that's a bit difficult to put together in a few simple words, because this whole thing is more than 280 pages long. But if we just look at the General Human Development Index, the HDI, that's good news, because most countries have been achieving progress over the last decades, and that's quite visible there. And that's continued also in the last year. But the top and bottom rankings, the same countries have been there for ages, like Norway, Switzerland, Australia, Germany are among those with the highest development and the lowest on the scale. We've still got several African countries like Niger and the Central African Republic. And I asked Selim Jahan whether there are some big surprises, and he said this.
Some countries have moved from high to very high human development group, for example, Romania. Some of the countries have moved from medium to high human development, for example, Uzbekistan. And some of the countries like Kenya, Nepal and Pakistan have moved from low to medium human development.
So there are no really remarkable changes, but the general movement is up, like from a low category to a higher category, except for these countries where there's, for instance, conflict.
The second set of changes that there are certain countries which have dropped both in terms of value and in terms of rank. And those are predictable, countries like Syria, Libya, and Yemen.
Now, he mentioned Syria, Libya, and Yemen, countries where there's war and crisis. Where do these countries stand now?
You can see in the development, in the Human Development Index, what happens if crisis and conflict takes a long time. And for instance, I looked for Syria. After 6 years of war, the education system and lots of other systems are really suffering. And it's now fallen back in this Human Development Index to the levels it had in 1990. That's when the first Human Development Report came out. So between 1990 and 2012, Syria, for instance, really went up every year, and it's very visible. And then the conflict started, and you see a very stark, like, slipping back. And that's, of course, very sad. And of course, it's also the case in Yemen and other areas of conflict.
And now, we've briefly touched upon this before. This year's report puts special emphasis on human development for everyone. What exactly does that mean?
Yes, they do draw attention to the fact that there are still lots of people, lots of groups of people that are left behind, and they do not benefit in the same way from human development.
What we have highlighted in this particular report, as far as the groups left behind, are basically women and girls, indigenous peoples, ethnic minorities, persons with disabilities, LGBTI communities, and so on.
Salim Jahan also told me that, for instance, as many as 18 countries, women still need their husband's permission to take up a job, which is pretty unbelievable. And every year, 15 million girls under 18 are getting married. And that's one child bride every 2 seconds, which is a very high number. So these girls, for instance, drop out of the education system, and that means they are lost for further employment.
Whenever there are losses for the groups, it's for the whole society. I'm using the example of women and girls. You cannot have sustained or sustainable human development if that human development bypasses half of humanity.
And that's, of course, why it's so important that it's not an individual problem. It's a problem for the whole society, for the whole world. But it's also important to take into account that one country can also have different speeds within the country. If you take Nepal, for instance, and there are different ethnic groups, different minorities within Nepal, on average, the country has moved up in the human development index from low to median human development. It now ranks at 144. But you basically have three different kinds of speeds of development there, depending on who you look at in Nepal. The high caste, the Brahmins, and then you've got the Muslims and the Dalits, which is sort of the lowest caste. And they are the most disadvantaged people. And all these groups have different levels of development. So averages don't always say much, basically. And you have to break it up.
So how exactly does the report measure human development? What kind of data has been used?
The data is from a number of sources, usually government data, and of course from a lot of UN organizations as well, like UNICEF. You've got a number of tables with different topics, like, as I said, the Human Development Index. Then there's also gender development, gender inequality, also general population trends, and, for instance, health. For instance, you have life expectancy, income, education level, school enrollment, and so on. And pretty much everyone agrees on those. But the question is, how good is the quality of development? Like, for instance, if you take education. So, for instance, 1/3 of children who've been through 5 years of primary school have problems with math and with reading. So does that count as good education?
No, not really. So you mentioned quality. How do they measure then the quality aspect of development?
Well, that's exactly one of the problems, because they can't really do that so well in the HDR index so far. It simply can't cover everything. But that's also why politicians should not just relax, because all the countries have stuff to do. I mean, there's no country with a 100% everything's great, not even the top countries.
So Anke, what's the takeaway message here from this report?
Well, I would say basically it tells policymakers to focus on those groups in society who are still disadvantaged. And that would mean that you must have universal policies in terms of inclusive growth, employment-led growth strategy, financial inclusion. So they encourage them that you need specific measures for people with specific needs. And they're also making the point that human development will not be sustained if it's not resilient. That also goes and is in tune with the climate change discussion. And with HIV and all these other challenges that the global society is dealing with. And they're also trying to push for more development in post-conflict situations, which they say we have to really improve on. And also, I think the main point maybe is to say everybody needs to be empowered. People's rights have to be protected. So it's an appeal to governments also to keep that into account, because if you want development, that means you have to have development for everyone in society.
That was my colleague Anke Raspa talking to me about this year's report on human development. There's a cocoa crisis going on in Ivory Coast. Farmers in the West African country have been struggling to sell their cocoa beans. The demand for chocolate in emerging countries is not taking off as analysts had hoped. Add to that record cocoa yields in West Africa and speculative practices on world stock markets, and you have a recipe for meltdown in West Africa, where 70% of the world's cocoa grows. Alex Duval-Smith met some of those worst affected in and around San Pedro, the world's biggest cocoa exporting port.
On her homestead, just off the main road, 35-year-old Jenny Nalini grates a cassava root into a tub. We're in Putinadu, a village surrounded by lush tropical greenery about 20 kilometres along the coast from San Pedro. Cassava is all she's feeding her three children at the moment. Her husband, George, has delivered 2.8 tons of cocoa beans since October without being paid. Buyers owe him just over 3 million CFA francs, close to 4,600 euros. It's more than half his annual income.
We can't even raise chickens. I was in the kitchen just now. There's no fish. There's nothing. How are we going to eat? There's nothing. Is that normal? You work. You're tired. You need to eat before sleeping. It's hard. It's hard.
Some farmers have been paid. They needed income and had to sell at whatever price the buyers offered. In many cases, it's been below the amount set by the government for this season, 1,100 CFA francs per kilo. That's about €1.70, and it's the amount George wants for his work on his 5 hectares.
The cocoa earnings are crucial. With that money, I maintain the cocoa trees and the family, and I send my three children to school. So we're currently in debt to the school. I haven't been able to pay the school fees. I try to explain to the teachers that I'll be paid soon. Please be patient. Sometimes they chase away the children. They send them home. Tell your parents to send the money, they say. I am scared, especially for the children's future.
On a peur parce que l'avenir des enfants.
The musty smell of fermenting cocoa is running down this lane of trucks outside the Cargill plant. I've counted about 150 30-ton trucks, all different coloured trucks, with writing from their former lives in Germany, France, etc. But all with Ivorian plates and lined up here, hoping to unload their cocoa before it all rots and becomes worthless. 46-year-old Dauda Traore is sitting having tea with some other drivers. He's been waiting to unload the cocoa beans from his truck for 3 weeks.
Around 1988, when I was an apprentice, we also had this kind of blockade, but it hasn't happened since. It happens when the processing plants close down. There's only one, Cargill, that's working right now. And Cargill is buying at the price the transport companies want.
70% of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa. In the biggest producer, Ivory Coast, 6 million people, a quarter of the population, are said to depend on the crop for a living. Hundreds of thousands of them are currently suffering the knock-on effects of a range of factors out of their control. Heavy rainfall has created a bumper harvest this season. There's been a dip in the world's appetite for chocolate, and the cocoa price on the New York Stock Exchange is at its lowest for 8 years. Speculation, price fixing, and the vagaries of international hedge funds all play a role, as does politics in Ivory Coast. A few weeks ago, the government of Ivory Coast said it would order more processing plants in San Pedro to open and take in cocoa, but that hasn't had much success. The plants are owned by commercial companies who simply don't want to buy cocoa at what they see as an inflated Ivorian price. The trucks are still backed up, and the government has so far refused to dip into a cocoa stabilization fund, which was actually put in place to soften blows like these. Economist Yusuf Karius.
Cocoa is not something transparent in the economy here. When you go to the farmers, it seems that the regulation, some of that is not applied on the ground in terms of quality, in terms of how people respect the price, and they need to improve it. The regulation should probably be modified or improved in the sense of the confidence that the farmers here in Côte d'Ivoire needs to have. And we need also an institution, a regulator, which is able to control and to reinforce its impact on the ground.
In a church hall, jammed between cocoa processing plants, 20 heads of farming cooperatives are holding a meeting. Sylvestre Kwame Kodjo believes the government is not triggering the stabilization fund because it's been mismanaged.
We call on the World Bank to get involved. We want to know where is the cocoa producers' money.
Each of the 20 men here represent 1,000 cocoa farmers in the San Pedro area. The cooperatives don't trust the government and believe the emergency fund money is gone, but they can't prove it. The government denies that the fund has been mismanaged, but it also refuses to use the fund to help the farmers.
If we had guns, we'd be heard. But we only have our bare hands. No one is listening to us.
Back at the farm, George takes me to see some cocoa trees. We wade through layers of dry brown leaves. Dead leaves, rotting cargoes of beans, impatient truck drivers and farmers. That's the picture as the cocoa crisis continues in Ivory Coast. Alex Duval-Smith, DW, San Pedro, Ivory Coast.
And from chocolate to fried chicken, South Korean fried chicken, that is, which has taken Asia by storm. Some of the country's most popular chicken franchises have opened up locations throughout East and Southeast Asia. Can you ever have too many chicken restaurants? Well, turns out yes, you can. In South Korea, there are so many chicken restaurants that regulations had to be passed to limit the number of these businesses from opening on one block. And there's a dark side to Korean fried chicken, and it's causing some restaurant owners to go broke, as Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
For 35-year-old Kim Dahae, nothing beats a night out with friends, drinking beer and sharing a box of fried chicken. But to most South Koreans, like her, this is not American fast food.
I don't think it's American food, it's Korean food now. Korean chicken developed in a very special way, and it's now Korean food.
Kim says what makes Korean fried chicken special is the marinades, like soy sauce and garlic, as well as coatings, like the quintessentially Korean flavor called yangnyeom. Lee Seon-young, who runs a chicken and beer restaurant, squeezes the sweet and spicy sauce over a batch of crispy tenders that he's just pulled out of the deep fryer. Unlike KFC's Colonel Sanders' original recipe, the ingredients for yangnyeom are no secret.
I usually just buy it, but it's made of sugar syrup, pepper paste, ketchup, and paprika powder. Ah, and some other stuff.
There are around 50,000 chicken joints in South Korea. There are just under 19,000 Kentucky Fried Chicken locations worldwide. Most here are franchises and deliver right to the customer's door via motorbike. It's not unusual for there to be dozens of these small restaurants in any residential neighborhood. Jung Eun Jung researches rural economics and is the author of a book on the history of Korea's chicken industry. She says chicken restaurants exploded onto the scene 20 years ago after the Asian financial crisis, which took a big toll on Korea's economy.
A lot of middle-aged men were fired from their jobs then, and many of them opened chicken franchises. It was cheaper to open this type of place compared to other kinds of restaurants. So these restaurants became popular, not because Koreans like eating fried chicken so much, but because suddenly there were just so many of these places, and then Koreans started eating more chicken.
She explains there's a notion here that if you want to own your own business, you should open a restaurant. Dining out is a big part of the culture here, and entrepreneurs think they will always have plenty of customers. Jung says they believe that opening a restaurant is easy, even if you have no experience in the food industry or know how to cook. So entrepreneurs pay for culinary classes at chicken academies run by the franchises. Shin Hyun-ho runs a school in Seoul. He teaches newcomers to the business how to cook as well as manage a franchise. A two-day course costs $1,500. He says it's a competitive industry, but it's still easy to be successful.
Everyone likes chicken, so there are plenty of customers. And the initial investment doesn't have to be that much. It's up to the new owner.
A low investment is what attracts many entrepreneurs into the chicken business. 3 years ago, Park Ji-kyung opened this restaurant. Like many franchise owners, he took out a loan to get things started. His was for $150,000. The 45-year-old already ran his own business, a sign-making company, but he says he needed to earn more money to support his family.
I'm at an age when I need to earn more money so I can pay for my two kids' private education to get them ready for university. But running this kind of business was harder than I thought it would be.
Park's restaurant is one of about 50 chicken places in this Seoul neighborhood called Gumho, where about 15,000 people live. And he says the competition, as well as the lackluster economy, is making it almost impossible to earn any money.
Well, on average, in a month, I don't make any money at all. After paying back the loan, buying ingredients, paying my staff, and paying rent, my profits are zero. Right now, nothing.
Chicken industry book author Jung Eun Jung says Park's situation is typical. Most franchise owners never make a profit. Jung says many franchises themselves go out of business, and the ones that survive don't help their clients, who must continue to pay licensing fees. She says franchise owners can't close their restaurants either, because then they really lose everything.
Most chicken restaurant owners use their apartments as collateral when they take out a loan to open their restaurants, so they also lose their homes when the business fails.
Jung estimates that each year, about half of all chicken restaurants in Korea go out of business. But that's not stopping new entrepreneurs from entering the market. And because of a lack of jobs for college graduates, restaurant owners are getting younger. Like 31-year-old Lee Son-young, owner of My Neighborhood Chicken Joint. Lee says he knew how tough the chicken business was when he opened this place 6 months ago. And that's why he didn't go with a franchise.
I think it's not so easy to be successful in this business if you open up a chicken franchise. It's too easy to open these types of places, even if you know nothing about chicken. You don't learn how to become competitive. I think if I am in control of my business, I make the decisions on my products, and I can be more successful.
Lee tells me there's even an expression to describe the competition between restaurants.
We call it the chicken game. People lower their prices to be competitive, and they end up putting themselves out of business.
Lee says business is so far going pretty good. He doesn't have to play the chicken game. Jason Strother, DW, Seoul.
And for our last story, we're in for another culinary treat. A restaurant in Madrid has been pulling in the crowds since it opened last November. But the Robin Hood restaurant, as it's called, attracts very mixed groups. During the day, it's a typical Spanish eatery, but at night, it only caters to homeless people who are served a free dinner. Haha Yopse has the story.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and all the tables at the Robin Hood restaurant are taken. By day, this is a typical Spanish bar with a cigarette machine in the corner and a leg of ham on the counter. Today, Elena Sanchez is enjoying a dessert with a friend.
Muy bien cocinada, muy limpio, muy, muy rico.
The food is very well prepared. Everything is very clean. It's very good.
Another customer is Debbie, a British woman who lives in Malaga and is visiting Madrid for the weekend. Finishing up her salad, she says she read about the Robin Hood restaurant in the newspaper and decided to check it out. In a few hours' time, the restaurant will transform into a completely different kind of eating place. And Debbie thinks it's a great concept.
And I think that if we can all come during the day or for breakfast or something like that and help people have something to eat at night, well, it's just amazing.
The Robin Hood restaurant is the latest initiative of the charity organization Mensajeros de la Paz, which means Messengers of Peace. The organization was founded 54 years ago by priest Ángel García Rodríguez, also known as Father Ángel. He preaches every Sunday at the San Antón Church a few blocks away. The church is packed as Father Ángel gives a sermon. In conservative Spain, he's considered a bit of a revolutionary. His church, for example, is open 24/7 and has a Wi-Fi connection. In winter, homeless people are allowed to sleep on the church benches. After the sermon, Father Ángel explains why he decided to open the Robin Hood restaurant.
Las colas de gente que había pasando frío para poder comer un bocadillo por la noche, decíamos.
I saw the long lines of homeless people standing outside in the cold, waiting for a sandwich, and thought, this is the 21st century. It shouldn't be like this. Why can't these people have dinner in a restaurant instead, just like the rest of us?
Father Ángel explains that the Robin Hood restaurant is about more than just feeding the poor.
Lo que sí queríamos es que tuviese más dignidad, que sean con camareros.
We wanted the Robin Hood restaurant to be a place with dignity, a place where the homeless are served by waiters and can drink out of a glass instead of plastic cups. It's just like in a normal restaurant. Furthermore, every night they have a table reserved especially for them, just like the rest of us when we go out to dinner.
It's now 8:30 in the evening and the Robin Hood restaurant is again packed. But regular customers have been replaced by those in need. The food is served in two shifts. This way, 100 people selected by the city's social services are guaranteed a seat here every night. 46-year-old Olga certainly needs this help. She is enjoying a Spanish omelette and says she has been unemployed for 9 years.
Que por ponerme enferma de dos contratos indefinidos, uno lo he perdido en el 2007.
Until 2007, I had two steady jobs. But after some major surgery, I wasn't able to work for several months and ended up being fired. Right now, I'm living on 400 euros each month in benefits. It's not enough. I'm lucky because my rent is only 150 euros. But I don't have money to pay the electricity or gas. So right now, I don't have any gas, a refrigerator or hot water.
Being able to have dinner at the Robin Hood restaurant means a lot to her.
Donde puedas comer sentado en una mesa dignamente y no sea un bocadillo.
It's so nice to have dinner at a proper table. It's horrible having to queue in the streets for a sandwich. The worst is the shame. I'm always afraid my friends or family will see me.
52-year-old Antonio is sitting at the same table. He left Seville back in 1996 and has lived all over Spain since then, mainly on the streets or in social service centers. He says he spends the entire day looking forward to dinner here.
There's no place where the food is as good as here. Besides, during the day, I'm always by myself on the streets. So it's nice that in the evening, I can come here and talk to other people.
I'm probably a bit heavier. Each evening meal consists of 3 courses and unlimited drinks. The name of the Robin Hood restaurant provides the clue as to how this service is financed. The money earned during the day from those who can afford to eat here pays for the free meals for the homeless in the evenings. The chefs and waitresses work during the day as well as evenings, and some volunteers help out in the evenings too. The Robin Hood restaurant is providing Madrid's homeless with a welcome alternative to soup kitchens and sandwiches. And if the initiative is successful, Father Ángel is planning to extend the scheme. Hagar Jobse, DW, Madrid.
And that's all for today on World in Progress. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/World in Progress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Just search for DW English. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Iliane Gliaducci and Michael Springer. I'm Sarah Steffen, and this was World in Progress. Bye for now.